I apologize for the delay. I also apologize for the challenging access to the capital issues that we're dealing with today. Just not even occurred to me as we were getting ready for this meeting that we were going to be running into, and I take full ownership of that because the construction project was part of my doing. So. Oh yeah, we are. Well, and then this was something that I was pushing for this last session, and it's going to be a great improvement once we get through it. But I apologize for the navigation challenges and appreciate all who have come to attend our Women in the Economy Commission meeting today, September 14, 2015. Commissioners and guests, all thank you for your time and for navigating the all the different challenges. So the first thing I'm going to do is entertain a motion for the minutes that were sent by Gail. Thank you, Gail, for putting those together. Or if there are any additions or corrections that were noted from our meeting of July 16th, 2015. No corrections. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Senator Escamilla makes a motion. Do I have a second? Thank you, Judy Barnett. Second. And so all those in favor adopting the minutes of July the 16th indicate aye.
Aye.
Super. Thank you so much. We do have a couple of presentations before we jump into updates from work that we are engaged in as a commission. And our first one is by Barb Muriel, who is a policy analyst for Community Action Partnership of Utah, related to issues on our recent poverty survey that was a
report
by the Community Action Partnership of Utah. And I think it's very timely given some of the questions and discussions we've been having recently.
Thank you. I made sure that I brought my Mac adapter and then left it in my car. So we're putting it on a different laptop, but I do have a handout to give out. This is actually just about to be slightly outdated poverty data. What I'm handing out to you is something that I put together last year. This is actually 2013 census data primarily. I'm so sorry. Okay, thank you. So the handout that I'm giving you is actually information that comes from this report that I'm holding up. I have a few hard copies that I can leave here. And also the entire report is available on our website, which I've also listed on that sheet. That sheet is just a highlight of some of the poverty data points that were identified in last year's poverty report. Just to give a little bit better explanation of where this data comes from. Primarily it's coming from the census, the American Community Survey, which comes out every year in September. So we're actually about to start updating this report. We do this report and release it right about December, January every year. The state-specific data comes out in September, but because it is the census and they're working on data for the entire country, when they are looking at more restricted geographic areas, in this case county data, they release a five-year average data in December. So the American Community Survey has one-year data that we use to analyze poverty over time at a state level, and then the five-year data is just a rolling average of a five-year period of time that comes out in December, and that's what we use to look at smaller geographic areas, like I mentioned, counties. So in our full poverty report, we have a snapshot of poverty in the U.S., and then we have a snapshot of poverty in Utah, and then we get into some county-specific data as well. So like I said, I'll leave a couple of the hard copies that we have left, and then I also encourage you to take a look at our website for the full report. It's about 84 pages long, so there's quite a bit in there. But I've tried to make it quite readable so that it is an approachable way of looking at poverty. And what I would like to do today is actually look a little bit more specifically at poverty in Utah as it affects women. Obviously, this discussion is looking at ways of strengthening the financial security of women, of parents, female householders that have children, particularly single parents, and we'll talk about why. I have one slide in here that I didn't quite get a chance to finish, so I'm going to, I had to do a little bit of last-minute math on it that I didn't quite have the time for, but I'm going to complete this, and I can certainly make this available to any of the members that would like this. Well, one thing I'd like to start with, are you all able to see this okay? Great. So let me start with poverty by family status. First off, the poverty rate in Utah as of last year is, oh, thank you, I appreciate that. I need to not look at my own laptop anymore, I'm going to do this one. Married couple families in Utah have a 6% poverty rate. So this is something that we know that having a two-parent household is a good thing when it comes to financial security. Now, the census, of course, has been looking at traditional married households, but I would imagine that as it moves forward, it's going to look at married households, whether that be same-sex or whether it be heterosexual couples. But having two parents in the home that have income and support for children certainly is better in terms of reducing the poverty rate. But then when you look at the next figure, female-headed households with children under 18, it's a 36.6 poverty rate. If you have a female-headed household with children under 5, that actually goes down to 38. It goes up to 38%. So female-headed households, single mothers, really struggle when it comes to poverty in Utah. Yes, go ahead.
Just a clarifying question. So married couple, when you mean female-headed household, is that not including if there's child support or...
The census defines it as no spouse present, so there may be child support,
okay.
But that there's no spouse in the home that is provided.
It's literally just someone that's by itself in the household.
Correct.
So we don't know if there's child support involved or not.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And that may be something, as you can imagine, the census data is rich and quite in-depth. So it's something I can look into, but my understanding is, yeah.
We had social services and probation overseas, the Office of Recovery Services. So it's an issue that we discuss all the time in the legislature, and I think it does make a difference when there is income of, child support involved versus no extra income for the household.
Absolutely.
That would totally make to me at least a difference. So thank you.
Yeah. I need to actually grab one sheet of paper for the minute. I want to back up a little bit. This is a slide that I was working on. Like I said, I will finish this table for you and send this out to you. But I really wanted to look at the poverty rate for women, specifically by subgroup. So in this particular case, I did some math and I looked at different racial and ethnic groups. And I'm just going to go ahead and give you the rate. If you'd like the actual raw numbers, I'm happy to give that to you as well. But for white alone, so this is women who identify themselves as white, non-Hispanic, the poverty rate is 11%. For Hispanic women of any race, the poverty rate is 27%. For Black or African American women, the poverty rate is 38%. This is just in Utah. American Indian or Alaska Native, 31%. Asian, 20%. Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, 31%. Those who identify as another race, 31%. And those who identify as two or more races, 20%. So the rate of poverty among women who are minorities, ethnic or racial minorities, as you can see, jumps quite a bit. Again, just to give some perspective, again, that rate of white alone is 11%. Educational attainment, this is something that is often talked about in terms of how it correlates to poverty. This is one of those slides that I always get a great reaction from when people see it. Now, this is taking into consideration male and female. Poverty rate by educational attainment in Utah, individuals 25 and older,
less than high school graduates. So this is neither a diploma nor an equivalency is almost 25%. A high school graduate, including those who have equivalency, is 12%. So it drops almost in half just by having that high school diploma or equivalency. Some college or associates drops even further to about 8%, and those with a bachelor's degree or higher is about 5%. So having the most basic level of education or training tends to be a huge predictor of whether or not somebody is going to end up in poverty. The interesting thing about this is when you start looking at our high school graduation rates, and Utah has done considerably better over the years. If you look at the trend since even 2008, Utah has improved graduation rates considerably. So I've broken this down a little bit, because one of the things I think is interesting when we look at that, those female poverty rates by subgroup that I mentioned earlier, you can see how much of a difference it makes what category you fall into in terms of race or ethnic background, whether or not you have a higher chance of graduating from high school. I won't go over all these numbers, but you can see that all students in Utah have an 83% graduation rate. White females actually have one of the highest graduation rates in Utah, of 85%. They're actually historically higher than males, and they have been for the last 10 years, according to the Utah State Office of Education. But you can see their graduation rates for ethnic minorities, racial minorities, are still falling, in some cases, desperately low, particularly when you look at English learners and students with disabilities. And the reason, of course, I bring this graduation rate table up is because you saw in that previous slide how much having that basic level of education plays into the poverty rate. But then I want to look at poverty rate by educational attainment. Now, remember that females tend to have a higher graduation rate in Utah than males, but then we look at the poverty rate by educational attainment in Utah. And you'll see that women fall on the higher end of the poverty rate in each of these measurements. Less than high school, 22% poverty rate with all males, 26% with women. High school of equivalency, about 10% for males, 14% for women. Some college or associate, 6.8 for men, 9.4 for women, and then a bachelor's degree or higher, just about levels of playing field with 4.5% and 5.4% for women. This is also one of the things, you think about the poverty rate. The poverty rate is actually quite low. A lot of folks hear about the poverty rate, but don't always remember what it's based on. It's based on a calculation of the price of food in the 1950s, and then they came up with a formula to expand that based on the number of people in the household, and that's how they measured the poverty rate for several decades. There's lots of arguments about whether or not we should continue to use that or not. But we do. So keep in mind that when we talk about the poverty rate, we're talking about a very low level of income. So what's really interesting is to start looking at the median educational earnings by educational attainment in Section Utah and the huge disparity in each education level. Starting with the entire population, there's about a $20,000 yearly median education or income disparity between men and women. And then you start to see that breakdown, less than high school graduate, high school graduate, some college or associate's degree, bachelor's degree, graduate, or professional degree. And it remains in each of those categories between about $15,000 and $20,000 per year between male and female median earnings based on educational attainment. This plays into another thing that has been talked a lot about in the legislature, certainly in community groups, is looking at affordable housing. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but this is something that a lot of groups argue the poverty rate should be based on. It should be based on the cost of housing, not the cost of food. Groups that measure cost of housing tend to say that affordable housing is 30% or less of your income for rent or mortgage and utilities. It's argued that a person should be able to afford average rent in Utah, which is about $813 a month for a two-bedroom apartment, that's average across the entire state,
a person would be needing to make $15.63 per hour to adequately afford that average housing. If somebody were working minimum wage, they would need to work 86 hours per week to afford average housing in Utah. Rent that's considered affordable for someone working full-time in a minimum wage job is $377 per month. I'm not entirely sure you can find employment at that rate in today's market. And then just to go into that a little bit further, about 50% of Utahns are actually renters, and they are considered cost burden. They spend more than 30% of their income on housing. 50% of renters are considered cost burden, and affordable housing is scarce for those in Utah with extremely low incomes, those earning 0 to 30% of the area median income. And 22% of Utah renters fall into this category, and it's estimated to meet the demand of that population, we would need about 42,600 units to help meet the housing demand of that population. And homelessness is certainly something that, despite what some recent reports on things like the Daily Show have mentioned, homelessness is certainly a problem that has not been solved in Utah. We've done a great job with chronic homelessness, but we still have a homelessness problem in Utah, about 13,621 in last year's count. 46% of those people are in families, and 36% are domestic violence victims.
Barb, I have a quick question on looking at it. Is it permanently centrally located within the urban area that we have the challenges with affordable housing, or have you been able to break it out based on county or other geographic locations, regions?
We do. In fact, in the poverty report, there is one entire section that breaks down the average rent per each county, and there is considerable information on the National Low Income Housing Coalition. In fact, that information that I just had on that slide comes from them. That particular slide is actually updated for the 2015 data. They have a wealth of information broken down by county, congressional district. And it's interesting, just a side note, community action agencies are actually a nationwide network that were created as part of the war on poverty in the 1960s. So the nice thing about that is that we have people throughout the state that are working on the same agenda of eradicating poverty. And as I go around and I meet with our community action agencies throughout the state and ask them what are the things that they see their clients struggling with the most, and all of them say housing as one of the top three. But it's interesting, when you look at something like Uinta County, 2 years ago they were struggling with is probably not the right word, they were experiencing a mining boom. So the average rent in Uinta County, so we're talking about Bernal, was actually the highest average rent in the entire state per count by county, at $915 a month for a two-bedroom apartment, which certainly somebody working in the mining industry could afford, but that economic boom was not necessarily trickling down into low-wage jobs. The retail workers, the Walmart and McDonald's workers, they were still earning a lower wage, and at $8-$9 an hour, they were unable to afford that kind of housing. Now, as that boom is starting to slow down, things will start to level out for them, but that was a real problem, and still continues to be to a certain extent. When I talked to the folks in Utah County at Community Action Services and Food Bank in Provo, they talked about housing, but they talked more about the lack of housing for people who are seniors or those with disabilities, because the market tends to want to provide housing to students and young families. So when you talk about housing as a problem in Utah, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It certainly is not the same from county to county. San Juan County, which traditionally has the highest poverty rate in the state, it's currently at 27%, has a very different housing problem than Summit County, which again is another county with high rent but has some lower wage workers that tend to work in the service industry and the tourism industry.
Thank you.
And again, poverty by race and ethnicity, this looks again at our poverty rates. I did a comparison actually from Utah to the U.S., and this includes men and women. This is a similar breakdown to the table that I mentioned before, so I'm not going to go into that too much. But we do tend to be, Utah has something to be proud of in terms of the fact that our poverty rate does tend to be lower
than the rest of the U.S., but we do have some places that we can work on. Certainly, our ethnic and racial minorities are a place you can see on the far right of that scale, Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander or Black or African American populations. We tend to have a higher poverty rate in Utah than they do on average for the rest of the country. And uninsured in Utah, this has of course been a hot topic, and this certainly plays into the poverty rate. So just something I want to touch on real quick. Our uninsured rate in Utah is, for young adults in particular, something to be a little bit concerned with. Percent of uninsured 19 to 25 is 20%, 18 to 64 is 18.5%. Our total number of uninsured is 14%. And then something I would like to highlight, children in Utah, when we're looking at the poverty rate, is always a concern. If you have low-income families, you would think that many of them would be on Medicaid or CHIP. But actually, the 85,000 children who are uninsured in Utah, about two-thirds of them are eligible for CHIP and Medicaid but are uninsured. And we also are greatly concerned about Hispanic children in Utah. We're about one in five are uninsured. And we rank 43rd in the nation for uninsured children. That's the wrong end of the scale, just in case you're wondering. And again, just to remind you, if you want to look into any more of the poverty data, any of the points that I've talked about today, not all of them are in the poverty report because I wanted to give you some specific poverty data points for women, but many of them are available. And I actually, this has given me, I think, the inspiration to add a section specifically about women in poverty in Utah for the upcoming report. So we'll have to see how that goes. Hopefully this is giving me the courage to put more specific topics in that maybe are sometimes a little bit difficult to highlight because it's controversial to highlight some of those things.
Would you please also send this PowerPoint to Yale so that she can distribute it as part of the minutes to all of our commissioners here? I think that I like the way it was emphasized. Very helpful. Thank you, Barb. Any questions have always come.
Thank you. This was very enlightening. When you start your report on women in poverty, I think it was Commissioner that mentioned you. Can you throw in that also gave the child support? Because, you know, the way scale is now, I got divorced in 1979, so of course there was no scale like there is now. And they take your assets and they bring it down, and then everything's 50%. So you may have a woman that's raising four children, but because she makes a fairly good salary, she'll be the one spending most of the money, and the husband, they may be on the same level of the salary, but we all know that, you know, soccer games and baseball games and dance and all that cost money, and unless you have an agreement with your, you know, your ex, then you don't always share that. So I'd be very curious to know, and I don't know how you do a scale on, you know, poverty. I don't know how you do it, but it really is something to think about.
I would be interested to look into a little bit more. One of the measurements that comes out, and this year will actually be coming out on the same day as the current population survey, which is the nationwide census data on poverty. That will be actually coming out on September 16th, so it's going to be coming out on Wednesday. On the same day, they're going to be releasing the supplemental poverty report, which actually takes into consideration some of the safety net programs that are a part of people's income but are post-tax. So a good example would be SNAP or food stamp benefits. They are not considered part of a person's income in the poverty rate. The earned income tax credit, which for some families can be thousands of dollars depending on the size of their families and the amount of their income earned, that is also not taken into consideration in the poverty rate. So the supplemental poverty rate looks at those post-tax benefits and also safety net programs that are not considered part of the income. So now I'm interested to see if child support is actually considered
as part of the income that's measured in the poverty data, or if it would be one of those income components that's only in the supplemental poverty measure. So thank you for giving me something to look into.
Thank you.
I believe it's going to be the supplemental
part. The child support. Child support.
But I'm glad you're going to look at that. Because I think, you know, we can even check also on how aggressive the state of Utah works to collect child support. And that's, again, policy conversation, right? And I know Senator Henderson has had some legislation. We've talked about this before where, this needs to be part of the conversation or solution of ending poverty for children. So that will be interesting data if we can collect that. The other one is Representative Chavez Howard and I had an opportunity to be at the NCSL national meeting of state legislators this last in our social services, health and human services. And there was a presentation from an individual that caught my attention, and he explained, you know, some of the penalties for getting married and how there's a lot of, you know, policy changing across the state and across the country to try to not penalize for some families getting married, penalty for their income tax returns, or especially tax purposes. And how is that promoting families when, you know, you're penalizing people for getting married? And it was just an interesting perspective that I think you said would be a good conversation as we try to, you know, have conversations of penalties and how that impacts on families. We were hoping to get more info. I'll definitely email him, and as soon as we get that, maybe we can continue that conversation. So I think a lot of it will be policy changes to try to help, you know, end the poverty. In terms of the healthcare, you know, and you mentioned, you know, 1 in 5 kids, Hispanic children are uninsured. And I still believe we have the highest rate of Latinos uninsured in the nation, I believe, per capita. And many of them do qualify. Where are things happening in terms of, a lot of them are mixed status families where you may have children qualifying for public benefits such as CHIP or Medicaid. A parent may be an employer-based, you know, insurance coverage, and then you have an individual parent floating, and they may have to go to the individual market. Are you seeing any, you know, efforts to educate families? I mean, this is across not only Hispanic families, but across, you know, every income household where they may have people floating from one place to another, and that's, so the insurance gap is not covered. I mean, coverage is not closing when you have those numbers still pertinent to our state, right? So this is something that I work quite closely with as a health policy associate with Voices for Utah Children. It's not something I spend quite as much time on recently, but it's certainly something that I've given a considerable amount of thought and effort toward in the past. A few of the things that we identify with in terms of uninsured children in Utah. One, the state used to have a fair amount of resources appropriated for outreach, particularly around CHIP. When CHIP went from a quarterly enrollment to year-round open enrollment, there was quite a marketing campaign that was actually paid for by the state, that they had a CHIP van, they had CHIP billboards, CHIP television ads. So the state was really very proactive in terms of educating parents about the insurance that was available for their children. So that's one thing. There is no longer, as far as I understand, any kind of additional preparation for outreach around CHIP. Medicaid is a whole other sort of can of worms when it comes to outreach around Medicaid. There were some efforts that were made to try to do some outreach around CHIP that was paid for by the providers of CHIP. It used to be Select Health and Molina were the only two providers of CHIP, and they actually did some co-sponsored marketing, but that was a difficult process. To try to make that work in a way that the state felt good about and that those two providers could feel good about. And I'd certainly be happy to have more conversations one-on-one about that if you're curious about that. Additionally, we tried as part of a coalition to work with schools, work with community groups. The school seems like an obvious choice. They are the people that have the access to the children. They are invested in having healthy children that can come to school ready to learn. One of the things that we continue to find is that they love the idea, but they were low on resources as it was. And particularly where schools tend to have different policies and governance based on the district, it wasn't something that you could easily implement at a statewide level. And we found the most cooperation from the schools that tended to focus on special education because they had employees that were actually dedicated to Medicaid billing. They had entire offices in many instances that worked on making sure their Medicaid billing was up to date, and they decided, why not take that staff that we have that's already knowledgeable about children Medicaid and have them help families that are trying to apply, not just to the children that qualify for disabled Medicaid, but they qualify for traditional Medicaid as well. But a piecemeal system is not terribly effective when it comes to trying to educate parents about very, very difficult policies. One other thing that Utah has that many other states have gotten away from is they have a six-month review policy for children on Medicaid, most children on Medicaid. So when parents are reporting income changes, say for instance, if they have food stamps or they have TANF and they report an income change, that income change is acted upon and it can affect their Medicaid or their CHIP as well. So there are some policies in place that tend to create what's considered, usually referred to as a deterring effect. You have children falling off on and off of CHIP and Medicaid throughout the year, which is confusing and frustrating for parents. So I would love to tell you that we came up with the silver bullet that would solve all the problems of getting these uninsured children that are eligible for these programs on these programs and keeping them on, but it's more complicated than that. I'm sorry I couldn't give you a better answer.
Well, that's very helpful. I mean, there's been patterns for years, but you will think that with ACA, they would have standardized more practices. The goal is to ensure as many children as possible and to be number 43 in the nation of having children uninsured. I think it's not reflect who we are as a state. It should be a fair thing for the state. And we should talk more about it so people know that we are not the caring state that we say we are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barb, for your presentation. There's a lot of information there that I think is really relevant to some of the things that we're discussing and trying to move forward with as a commission. I have a question about the housing data that you presented. It seems to me in conversations that I've had with folks associated with different municipalities and counties and then also school agencies that one of the main things that needs to happen on housing is to align around a common definition of what affordability means. And that is sort of the first step before you start to break out by population, whether that's elderly, disabled, homeless, working poor, and because each of those categories has unique needs and challenges. What I'm wondering for you from your perspective on this is, do you see policy pieces that are burdensome or are barrier creating in terms of the creation of more affordable housing or dealing with this issue in ways that maybe you see other states or even certain municipalities or counties in our state doing that maybe could scale out to across the state?
On this particular subject, I probably would have to defer to something like the Utah Housing Coalition. Policies around affordable housing is not my area of expertise. I certainly study the numbers in terms of how many people are struggling with affordability. Most of my understanding of housing is unfortunately a little more anecdotal, and I wouldn't want to assert things that might end up sounding like opinions into.
certainly there are areas that I feel a lot more confident. Children's health care is one of them, but I have a lot more data to back up my answers, but this is unfortunately not one of those areas. But I would certainly be happy to look into any area. If you have a specific question that you would like me to work into, I am more than happy to spend the time to get some good answers for you. A couple things about that I would feel confident saying. One, I think there have been a lot of conversation around good landlord programs, particularly in terms of all the legislation and policy work that's being done around criminal justice, and looking at making sure that we don't have programs in place that tend to put blanket policies on everybody that falls under, say, the category of felon. So good landlord programs are something that's being talked about. I also feel confident in saying that a lot of the people that we interact with, community action agencies, talk about their rights as renters, that they might find something that falls into the category of affordable, but it's neither safe nor clean. So I think those are the two areas that I feel good speaking about. I think, that, as I said, though, I certainly have people that I would refer you to that would be much more of an expert in this area, but I'm also happy to look into anything that you would like me to look at.
Okay. I may have some questions, and I'll contact you about that. It's just interesting, I think, in light of the need that exists, especially for some high-density, maybe mixed-income housing across the state. I mean, your example in Bernal is a really good one, and I think that exists, you know, in little pockets all around the state. So in light of that information we have, in light of the Envision Utah survey results that have just come out, it's interesting to see that we have a city like West Valley City whose city council just passed a restriction that no more lot size is smaller than a quarter acre in their city boundaries. And while we believe, I think we certainly support local control and city, you know, having the ability to control vision and destiny as a city, those needs exist across the state, and how we can accommodate affordable housing in every one of our municipalities, I think, is a continual point of focus.
Absolutely.
So, anyway, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for your information and for sharing this with us, and for agreeing to take a look at some of the other issues, the child support issue and maybe the housing issue that we can discuss online with Representative Edwards. But I think that we've heard a couple of commissioners inquire about the variable of child support on that, so if you could help us with that, that would be great.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Before we move on to our next presenter, in fact, maybe she wants to be working on toggling to her presentation. I wanted to welcome a new member of our commission. We've had some changes within the person who's appointed from DWS to serve as our staff support, and Commissioner Kathy Bonas, who is in your exact title, Director of the Division of Legal Services for Department of Workforce Services, will be here representing DWS instead of Carrie. We're transitioning into moving not away from research so much. I know our research committee is still working hard and we still have some work to do there, but we've had a number of questions related to policy directors. What can we do in terms of, within the context of our relationship with the department? Can we take positions? What would that look like since we're staffed by DWS? And so Kathy is here to help us navigate the next step of
in how we move forward as a commission, taking the initial research that we're having as we couple up with additional research and then moving towards deliverables and next steps. So we welcome Kathy. Kathy, do you want to just take a second and tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do for the department? And then I think I'd also just like to take a minute and have each of the commissioners introduce themselves so that you know who they are too.
Hi, thank you for having me, Kathy Bonus, Workforce Services. So I do a few things for the department. I'm John Perquant, General Counsel. I also run our adjudication division, which hears appeals from customers of our benefit programs, like food stamps, TANF, child care, unemployment insurance. All of our benefit programs, the customers have due process rights when a decision is made on their case, and so they're entitled to a hearing and a review board to review those decisions to make sure that they're handled appropriately. So I run the division that handles all of that work, and then I'm also the Director of Legislative Affairs for the department, so during the session, you'll see me up here around doing work for the department. So I'm excited to be a part of this. Being a woman in the economy working is an interest to me as well, so I'm grateful to be here, and I'm happy to help whoever you guys need.
And Marie, I'm going to have you start. We'll just go along with so we can introduce ourselves to Kathy here.
I'm Anne-Marie Wallace. I'm the Program Director of the Women's Business Center at the Shelton Chamber, and I represent Small Business on the Commission.
Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the Commission. I'm Trina Eyring, and I am a Senior Vice President and Director of Recruiting at Zions Bank Corporation and Zions Bank.
I'm Ann Burkholder. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the YWCA Utah.
Senator Liz Kamiya, we work together on some bills, and I also work for Science Bank.
And Representative Charlie Schaap, co-chair of the Commission.
Representative Becky Edwards, also co-chair of the Commission.
Judy Garnett, the Executive Director of Utah Labor Community Services and the Assistant to the President, Dale Cox.
Hi, Jim Robinson, I'm Associate Director of the Kempsey Gardner and Policy Institute at the University of Utah.
And I'm Senator Deidre Henderson.
I'm going to turn the mic over to Representative Edwards to introduce our next guest, if you don't mind. Representative?
Happy to do that. We have with us our next presenter, Melissa Fregain, who is the Director of Workforce Development at LSI, Logistics Specialties, Inc. And we're both Davis Countyites and have become acquainted because we serve on the Board of Directors of Safe Harbor for Domestic Shelter in Davis County. And through that, I have heard Melissa reference some of the work that LSI is doing to outreach and educate and train the very individuals that I think Barb mentioned, you know, these under and unemployed women who find themselves in need of training and kind of that next step to become self-sufficient with self-sufficient wages. And I think they're doing some exciting things, partnering with some of the other institutions in the state. And so I was really excited to have an opportunity to bring her on to our agenda. So thank you for being here. And
thanks for having me. And I wasn't nervous because I heard everybody introduce yourself, and I was going, oh, it makes me nervous. So I'm going to hand out these real quick. They're different than the presentations, so they're just leave behind for all of you. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. So my name is Melissa Fregain. I work for LSI, and what I'm going to do is just really briefly go through LSI. A lot of people are very familiar with LSI and our consulting services, but a lot of times people will ask me, how do you go LSI business consulting to the work that you're doing on your job training and placement programs, et cetera? So I'm going to go very quickly. Please feel free to stop me and ask questions. But I'm going to go quick and then deep dive into some example success stories at the end of the presentation. So historically, LSI was founded in 1972. We are a business development consulting firm. We really help companies with strategy, process, training, capture management, essentially growing their business and growing jobs through working with federal government. So contracting. So our typical employer base would be Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, BAE, those sorts of, especially up in the northern Utah area surrounding Hill Air Force Base, but working with military all over. That's just in general. So about 8 years ago, LSI began an economic development program, and about 2 years, they hired me. So the economic development program through LSI, you can see I've listed them here, and I'm not necessarily going to read them off, but really we really are working towards creating a demand for new jobs, targeting the un and the underemployed through some of our workforce development systems. We want to increase the tax base, really help develop workforce strategies that have that integrated human services approach, and of course really focus on some of the industry clusters and some of the momentum that the state of Utah in terms of economic development has. So for example, the UAMI project through the IMCP designation, Utah was designated as one of the top for the next 12 advanced manufacturing industries. So really trying to synergize with some of those items, as well as work with the workforce development, but really synergize those aspects of what we do. So I'm going to talk about three engagements through the economic development arm of LSI. Really, they're job creation and talent development. And the whole focus is that integrated approach. So when you think about economic development, a lot of people think about job creation. So they think about how are more jobs either attracted in the state or grown in the state. And then we talk about workforce development and some of these issues with our lower socioeconomic or people in poverty in two different approaches. And so what we're trying to do is really look at synergizing both approaches. So the first program, and this was established in 2007, and this is a job creation program. LSI is contracted through the Utah Procurement Services to partner with GOED and PCAC to provide services to small and medium-sized businesses. You can see the outcomes. They're very, very successful. It's a great program. And it's really the job creation and the genesis of this idea about working with these companies to understand their needs as a growth, needs in terms of business development, and then what are their other needs as they're working through the program. So the second program that I want to talk about, our engagement, was a pilot program that completed June 30th of this year, and it was called the Economic Expansion Program. It was established in 2014 as a joint GOED-DWS initiative, and the idea was to take that Utah procurement idea where you're working with small and medium-sized businesses, extend your consulting services and work with large companies, and then provide them workforce development strategies. And so you can see the goals of the program were 125 participants, and we had 130. Referral services, 75, and we averaged about 284. And these aren't just, hey, go see this person or go talk to this, but really the referral services were touch points where they actually benefited from that referral service. And then jobs created and placement. And these two outcomes, the goals were 63 and 50, and they're asterisks because that data comes back to us from the Department of Workforce Services through the Unemployment Insurance Quarterly Wage Data Report. So the results that you see on the other side, the 222 jobs created and the 392 people placed in those jobs comes from DWS from those reports. So, and that's three quarters of the data. So we're looking forward to the fourth quarter and seeing the full outcome of what we did in this pilot program. And that, just really briefly, sorry to go back, that really was that synergy between the job creation and the talent development piece, that placement idea of understanding what the company needs are, whether it's small, medium, or large businesses, and really integrating some of the workforce development strategies that we were working on to assist them. And then we did this really by not only the business development services and the workforce solutions, but really integrating that university and education piece and helping the companies do what we call a MediCareer pathway. We're calling it that because a lot of people have specific ideas about what an apprenticeship is or what an internship is or looks like. And we wanted to come up with a term that was really more well-rounded than that, which really meant education and sort of this experience piece or this working piece with the employer at the same time. And then we target, from a strategy standpoint, people who are part of our talent program, which I'll talk about next, veterans, people with disabilities, etc. So the job training and placement program, we, when the DWS sent out the RFP to the CANF program, we applied. I believe, I don't know this 100%, but I believe we're the only for-profit agency awarded from that program. We were awarded a contract November 1, 2014, and extends to October 31st, 2017. And really our target is the underemployed, unemployed, some of our intergenerational poverty families and underrepresented populations of veterans, disability, women, and minorities. We really take what we call a 3E model or approach, where we're looking at employability, experience, and enrichment. So if you look at the outcomes listed there, we have about 78 participants right now. We're onboarding some. We'll have up to 90 in the next week and a half. So you can see that 47 of the 78 are receiving some form of state assistance. The 1152 is the monthly average for all of those 47 who come to us on state assistance. 33 of them were already working in some job. It could have been a part-time job or any job when they came to us. And then you can see the breakdown of their education level. So we are working with a pretty, a lot of a mix here, where one person has their master's degree, seven with EAs, nine associate degrees, and you can read the rest, of course. So we really are also dealing with educated individuals who are still struggling. And we can talk about the eligibility for JANA, just in general, 200% of poverty, an eligible child in the home. So that's essentially all of these individuals are eligible for the program, so that essentially they are in poverty. So the way we really work with these individuals, of course we do the eligibility first, and then we really work on the employability. The employability is the most important aspect of what we do. It's really the way we customize the approach with all of our participants. So when we sit down with them, employability can mean a couple of different things. Some people want to talk about soft skills. Employers hire for soft skills, so they're looking for soft skills. When you talk to industry, any industry, there's oftentimes a conversation of, look, we can teach somebody to do the job, but we need somebody who's going to show up on time, have good communication skills, and fit into our organization. And so the employability skills can be soft skills, but they're also, and they're showing up on time, then we need to take care of transportation issues if that's a barrier for them, as an example. So the employability skills is really what helps somebody get and keep and maintain a job. So we look at the employability, we create an employability action plan for them if there's some deficiencies in their employability, and then we set goals, and it's all customized to what that individual wants to do. The experience piece is really to do that on the job training, internships, employment, and really start developing that career path. A lot of the individuals that we work with don't have work experience, and so sometimes it's a matter of just getting that internship to get that letter of recommendation to get some work experience behind them. And then the enrichment piece is really that long-term follow-up. So once they get from the job, are they working 6 months later or 12 months later, and how can we continue to develop that individual towards self-sufficiency? Just getting somebody a job doesn't mean they're self-sufficient. So each time we go back and we update that employability action plan. So if somebody checks off, yes, I went to take care of my resume, then we go back around, and if they have experience, did you update your resume? And resumes need to be tailored for each job that you're applying for, so on and so forth. So you can see it's a pretty intensive mentoring environment, and that mentoring is really critical in the success of these families. So the why, we want to improve lives with young under and re-employed. And the re-employed individuals are maybe those people who may be potentially losing their jobs or have been ripped or a reduction. restructuring, of course, and then need to find more employment somewhere. We want to reduce state costs, increase state revenues, and then, of course, this in turn spurs economic development for the state. So really that's the job creation and talent development piece. So the JCTD, I guess, sort of color-coded on job creation, talent development, and the actual ROI. The way we factored this was we did it in an annual basis. So with our actual numbers total with the participants, the 78 that I shared with you, we have an average yearly income increase of $17,000. That's just using the personal income tax, the flat tax of 5%, that's $874 yearly tax revenue to the state. And then the average state assistance yearly is about $6,800. And the cost of the program for us to work with these individuals is about $2,200 per person. So when you factor all of that in, you have a return on investment for about $5,500. So the objective, obviously, is to create the demand for high-wage jobs. You don't want to get them any job. You want to make sure that they have a job that they can move up in career employment and career mobility. And then we target the unhired and re-employed for the supported employment training, the intensive resource integration and the placement aspects of it. So I played around with this number. This is completely, totally hypothetical. But if you took the 392 economic employment program participants placement that we had, and you just multiplied that by the $5,500 return on investment, that's a $2.1 million return on investment from the state of Utah. So the job training and placement program, because we're coming to talk about women in the economy, I wanted to deep dive into the women participants that we have. We have 47 of the 76 that are female participants, 33 of them are receiving state assistance. You can see $1,100 is the monthly average of the state assistance that they're receiving. 14 of them were working upon enrollment in our program at $10.74. Is their average starting wage. The education levels, you can see, still very high, master's degrees, 5 bachelor's degrees, etc. So when we talk about dealing with and helping and assisting customizing these employability action plans, we know that women have significant barriers to their employment. So really what we want to focus on for women in particular, among all the other items, but really in particular is the transportation, the child care, the mental health, soft skills, lack of education, and limited work experience. So that employability skills, again, is really the critical piece of it. You can see these are just what we have found in our individuals in our program. These are the biggest problems for them, the biggest barriers that we want to help them access resources to alleviate those barriers. Transportation is huge, affordable, reliable child care. You guys probably have heard this a lot. You are very, very aware of these items. So the way we do this is we really integrate industry, education, government, and community-based organizations. We don't duplicate any service that is already provided. What we do is we help and mentor our participants to access these resources, to understand that they're out there. A lot of times, they may go someplace to get a referral, go to the Office of Recovery Services as an example, but to really navigate that and to get there and to have your children taken care of in a daycare setting. And you can think about all of those things. So we can say go get help, but actually going to get help is a completely different story for individuals who have these significant barriers.
So, just some clarifying questions. Thank you. So you have a contract with BWS, correct?
That's correct.
And then, so they get referred to you, or how do you?
So we have outreach services, and we do have a partnership with the Department of Workforce Services. So we do get some referrals from the Department of Workforce Services, and then we really have an intensive partnership with other TANF recipients, contract recipients, so Colleges of Hope. I failed to mention this, but we serve Box Elder Weaver in Davis County.
Those are your towns.
Yes, and we just got it extended our scope of work was just extended to really work with the intergenerational poverty program with the Department of Workforce Services and Currents.
And yours, because they have to be kind of assistant, correct? So they all have children.
Correct.
What we say is the rate of female households only versus married couples.
Oh, that's, I have that data for you, but I need to grab my spreadsheet.
Okay, but I mean, you say 50%, 60%, any?
I would say probably about 65 to 70% are single mothers.
Okay, and then when you gave the a number of about $1,000 in benefits that they received, correct?
Correct.
$1,100. That includes everything. I mean, that's everything that's subsidized, correct?
Correct.
It's not only cash assistance, which is what we usually call PANAS, so that could be food stamps.
Correct.
What about health care? Is that included? Like,
it is included. And what we
that's
did...
That's pretty high, so I mean, I knew that people don't get that cash assistance. So,
yeah.
Okay.
And what it's factored in is for that monthly, what the cost of the state is of the monthly sort of what would be the equivalent premium. Yeah, but it's not the actual medical cost.
Correct. Yeah.
Because there's no way to account for that.
Yeah, so the premium that we pay is to subsidize the child on CHIP or Medicaid.
Correct.
Okay. That
helps
make a difference.
Yes.
You know, you think assistance, people usually think cash assistance for, you know, or welfare or whatever, which we don't use that term. So just having that clarified, it helps a lot. Thank you.
And Melissa, as you enter this discussion regarding industry, a question that I have is in working with corporate partners for placement, do you look to ones that have a rigorous support system for employees that might include on-site child care or a differential for education or those kinds of things that kind of complement what you're getting from some of the government programs, that specifically looking for, you know, family-friendly businesses that would augment what you're getting elsewhere? So.
Yes, but from a different direction. Really what we do is we work with employers because they have such a workforce need. We consult with employers to say, if you have a workforce need and you're interested in having more participants, then you may want to think about having daycare outside. You may want to think about having band pools or supporting transportation fees. So really what we're doing is consulting with the employer to become more friendly so that their workforce can be successful. And a lot of times with employers, it doesn't cost them anything. They can tweak and change shifts, for example, that doesn't necessarily cost them anything. It's just a matter of putting that those ideas and those contracts and consulting with them to say, if you want to solve your workforce needs, here are some strategies that you could incorporate.
I've been interested in kind of seeing the lay of the land of all the businesses that you work with that have incorporated those, and then maybe how that has helped them in terms of recruitment beyond this program. But anyway, just kind of seeing them integrating those recommendations and maybe your success rate with what that looks like. Thank you.
Sure. So I just have a couple of slides here, just kind of deep diving again on the industry piece. We've covered some of this. But you can see we've also worked with them on the customized internship programs as well, really helping them. Maybe they don't have someone who is credentialed in the way that they're looking for, but maybe they can hire someone as an intern to hire where they're learning the program for that company. And then once they are skilled and have that on-the-job training, then they can be hired on full-time and trained in that particular position. So that's another one of those strategies. So there's various strategies that you can work with through the industry. And my experience is the industry members that we work with are very, very ready to plug in. They're willing to do what it takes to increase their workforce and solve and create solutions to any problems that they have. So they've been very, very good partners. But that is the niche of what we do, is we bring industry on as a partner. So it's not just accessing, Department of Workforce Services training dollars, for example, but it may be help accessing the industry partner to help pay for some of those certifications that maybe they need. The intern, they help pay for some of those education tuition dollars, and then that helps them solve their own problem too. And then accessing things like custom fit, for example, or some various things like that. So it's working with those employers to help them create those strategies to reach out to the resources in the state of Utah.
We have a question. Yes. Thank you. So these corporate partners, are was it hard to find them? Are you finding
a willingness out there to change some of their practices and maybe thought processes to help make their work environments friendlier for women?
Actually, my experience is that they're very gung-ho and very interested. Really, when you reach out to one and you create a strategy, the word of mouth is such that they're all very interested in accessing. I think the difference is what really turns the tide for us is that we are also an industry partner. And so when we were able to sign a non-disclosure agreement with them, an NDA, we were able to really understand what it is that they needed so that when we were providing them strategies, it was a customized strategy for that employer specifically. And, of course, we wouldn't share that competitive information. So even something like a wage, as an example, when you're in the contracting area, that's proprietary information. They're competing to win contracts really against each other. So understanding, being able to sign the NDA and being a peer and access, being able to help them access a different niche of workforce and talent, they were very gung-ho. And we also want to look at, like I mentioned before, any of the things that are going on in Utah, targeted clusters, UAMI, the IMCG designation. How can we help our industry with some of their workforce needs? So the resource strategy, support, and integration, those other three boxes, we really partner with the educational institutions, really through their non-traditional student centers, for example. We try to help place Trinity graduates in some of these internships so they can do an intern to hire. We also work with the government agencies, Voc Rehab, for example, or VA. That's mostly, we don't have any female veterans right now. But Health and Human Services, I bring up Weaver Human Services. One of the success stories I'm going to talk about is accessing human services as well. And then DWS is a wonderful, wonderful partner. They provide us referral services. We refer people back to them as well and help with training dollars and when others are eligible. And so that partnership and that communication make it key. Department of Workforce Services really does quite a bit with a lot of our participants. And so helping our participants understand what's available to them and working with EWS is really one of the highlights of the program. It's not just, okay, you have the contract, go do what it is that you do. It really is a partnership that is working very well. And then the community-based organizations as well, I mentioned this before, organizations such as all these employment services or Cottages of Hope, People Helping People, Safe Harbor, Family Support Center, you guys recognize all of these agencies. The community-based organizations have resources and they have niches where they help support families. And so being able to understand and really keep almost an asset map of what we have in our areas so that when we understand what that employability action plan is, we can not only create that plan for them, help refer individuals to them, but if they need further help, if we need to help. So we have government agencies. We have a partnership with UTA. We're piloting a community van program with them. We're the first to try it. It's a van pool where we're able to rent and lease vans to help our participants get to and from some of these employment-related services. So that's a brand-new program. They had to go all the way up to the feds to get that approved, so that's a pretty exciting, fun program to really help that transportation piece. And then, of course, transportation and van pools, and I mean, UTA has a number of resources and programs to help with transportation. So the community-based organizations are really, when we tie in the education, government, and community-based, you can see that there's a holistic wraparound set of resources, and instead of these siloed areas, it's really pulling all of them together and then helping individuals, mentoring them through navigating some of that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we dive into a couple of success stories. So you can see our outcomes, men versus women, in our program. The average number of days is 163 days in the program for men. Women, the average number of days is 140. You can see the job placements and the educational placements. You can see the average placement wage of those coming in on of the unemployed, and then the average placement wage for the underemployed as well. And for this purpose, underemployed can be long-term unemployed, but for this particular exercise, we are looking at those who come to us with any employment. The interesting thing that I highlighted in red was the average wage increase. When we worked with individuals, for women, it was more than a dollar more per hour when we helped find them a new job. We're really looking and deep diving why is that? Is it that we're helping them highlight some of their skill sets? Is it that they're actually asking for more and posturing themselves to have higher wages? Is it that we're working with employers more to be more friendly? You know, there could be a whole number of things, but we're very interested in that number. It's a very interesting number. So, and then you can see the average decrease in state assistance.
Melissa, I'm wondering if on that one, if the rate of what they were being paid was so non-parallel to where they really should have been earning that by the time they get the assistance from you, they are actually being paid a little bit more comparably to what they're worth. But I mean, I think that that's, anecdotally, I would venture to say that that's probably what I would pull on Senator Henderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Something that looks interesting to me too here is the average decrease in state assistance is so much. It's less for women. Is that because they were getting less, or just because they still are getting some more because maybe they have children, or is that
that's Yeah, that's just the actual number decrease. So a lot of them could still be getting daycare assistance or some other assistance. Yes. So success stories, if I may. So these are anecdotal, but I think that they really highlight, and I can't put too many identifying pieces to this, but I did give you a detailed document and it's the actual story and some of the return on investment. So we have a single mother of two. She really is a first generation career woman. And she finished her office admin certification from the OWATC. And her grandmother, she lived with her grandmother, and she was, her grandmother was watching her two children. They were below the age, they were 6 and 3. And they had significant behavioral issues. The grandmother could barely keep up. And we helped her access Labor Human Services. She had no idea. They had intensive counseling, intensive family counseling. There's two fathers. We helped her go through the Office of Recovery Services as well. Now she's also receiving child support for one of her children. And she's no longer living with her grandmother. She has her own apartment. She's working full-time at a medical facility with her office admin at $13 an hour, which is not a huge amount of money. But it is full-time and has full benefits. And so she's secure. She's on her path to self-sufficiency. We will continue to work with her in the enrichment part of our program to make sure that if she needs more certifications or she needs more training, that we'll continue to help her with that. The other piece that we with this single mother is that she's bilingual. And so that was a huge asset, and we helped her sell that in her interview process. It's a huge skill to have, and lots of employers are looking for that. And so it was really a part of the success. She wasn't going to say that she was bilingual, right? That for her, it was just something natural, just her everyday, and we really wanted her to highlight that, and it was the reason why she obtained this job, as well as a married mother with two down at the bottom there. So another bilingual individual who was hired pretty much on the spot because of her skill set. So I can deep dive some more if we have more time. I'm not sure.
We're ringing a little low, so let's see if you've got any other questions or if you have any final thoughts to close.
Thank you, Melissa, and thanks for breaking that out for women specifically. That's very, very interesting.
one of your very first slides had what your goal was in terms of number of individuals that you were going to be able to serve, and then you far outreached that to like maybe quadruple the number. Do you have a max that you're going to be able to help? I mean, or is the need so great and your ability to meet that need sufficient that it can just continue to grow?
Right. Well, the Economic Expansion Program that showed the those numbers, that was a pilot program and it's no longer a program that is operational. We do have the TANF program, which we call the Dog Training and Placement. It is a three-year program. We serve 150 individuals per year based on that contract. And it's approximately $300,000 contract. Funded straight through TANF.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for this great information and for all the work that you're doing as a concert with DWS and the other partners. It seems like you have some really innovative, great ideas that we can probably continue to support. And thank you for the work that you do and for the information. Information is extremely helpful.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we have just a few minutes, but I do want to go ahead and circle with the chairs of the different subcommittees. I know that we're all, in some cases, in holding patterns, trying to gather additional information and additional funding in some cases for work to continue, but I do want to check in with those. Anne-Marie, let's start with communications. I know one of the things we were going to try to do is get you a co-chair, and I didn't know whether you had been able to convince one of the subcommittee members that's not a commission to join you as co-chair, or if you need their assistance in terms of finding folks that are on this committee. But where are we at there?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So last time I mentioned three priorities. We have requested a co-chair and had mentioned that I'd like to have a subcommittee meeting. I did send out an email to the subcommittee that was put together by Heather Barnum, and unfortunately I didn't hear back from all but one. So I anticipate that I'll have to rebuild the communication subcommittee with two major events that wasn't a high priority for me during the month. However, one thing that I did want to mention other than that, the three priorities for us, and I don't know if this is an appropriate time to do this, but you had mentioned last month about, and this is not communications entirely, but about the policy at the Chamber of Commerce, at the Dollar Chamber where I'm employed. So I did take time to meet with our policy team, and if we have just a couple minutes, I can share with you exactly what they told me. The Dollar Chamber was able to, they basically have 82% success rate in bills passed this last legislative session, which is incredibly high. So what they had mentioned to me was that they start with long-term principles first. Those are high, high level. And once they and they had those priorities for, excuse me, priorities, principles for many years, and those are in some key different areas. Once they, well, they've had those for a while, what they do each year is identify priorities for that year. And upon that foundation, and they actually take positions on different bills that are being passed. They had mentioned that they really look for slow momentum, so they don't take on something that's a brand new or a trendy kind of a thing. They had mentioned that they look for low-hanging fruit, excuse me, and also they try to lead with flexibility, so they mentioned three areas that they look for when supporting or deciding to support a position is the three things of public support, policy, and political support. So those things that they're looking for, again, they did mention to me it's all about the principles first. It would be something like fair employment as opposed to the wage gap. That makes sense for the priority, or excuse me, for the principal. And going from there, they do have a policy team that voices their thoughts on the issues as well. But that's what I found from the Salt Lake Chamber policy team, and they're more than happy to go over anything else if policy team wants to do that. But they really stress the point of high level principle first.
Super, thank you. I appreciate the work that you did on that, Commissioner. I just thought I was going to touch base with you, and I appreciate you following through on that. And this is going to be very helpful to our policy committee, so I appreciate your investigative work and the time you took to do that. So thank you. And then we'll work on, if anybody has recommendations of additional people outside of the commission who might be interested in joining the communications committee, please let Commissioner Walker know. And if anybody's interested in joining her as co-chair, but maybe we can get her an outside folk that might be able to help her with that too. So we'll follow up on that. Commissioner Robinson, research.
Okay, we're good. We are in a holding pattern, as you know, so I think we're going to visit later today and talk about some opportunities to explore some funding to do some of the research that we've identified. If I could, though, with the change of Carrie Maine not being on here, and I think Kathy, you're a terrific addition for DWS, we need the representation from that department. We have lost an economist on this team, and I think that's a huge loss. I think we need the skill set and the intelligence, the knowledge that an economist has on this group. And I would just ask if we could explore the opportunity to bring an economist back onto the commission at some point.
Okay. Thank you so much. Just in terms of the policy, the public policy group, when we were evaluating again what direction we want to go, and again, I want to thank Commissioner Wallace for her information. And priority for us has been working to try to garner some funding to continue the work on the focus group. So we're getting really close. We've had a really promising prospect come our way and hope to have that moving forward. Another thing I wanted to share, and I'm going to give a packet to both our to Commissioner Wallace and to Commissioner Robinson, but during the NCSL conference, I had the fortune to attend a presentation by the Center for American Progress, specifically looking on messaging poll on issues facing working families, and they were looking at women in the economy in general. And so they've done some really great polling on what messages work, what messages resonate with voters and other folks, with policymakers, what direction you want to go in terms of messaging, and also what the research is supporting. So I thought that was extremely helpful. It was very timely, so I picked up a packet for each one of you. There's also an organization called Moms Rising, and I wasn't familiar with it, but they did a presentation at that that confab with the Center for American Progress, and they have a blog, 1 million nationally. They do a women's radio show talking about women in the economy, about working women, and I thought it would be great for us to plug into what they're doing, and I see this is a great prospect for kind of maybe getting the word out about what we're doing. But that was just a couple of things that I picked up, so I'll give you both those packets. And I also asked them to send me a copy of the very detailed research PowerPoint. I haven't seen that yet, but this reminded me that I need to follow up with, and I'll make sure that both of you get that so you can share that with your individuals. And Representative Edwards, do you have any other additional thoughts on the policy committee?
We will hear some proposed legislation at our next meeting.
And with that, is there any other business to come before the commission before I entertain a motion to adjourn? No, seeing none. Thank you for those of you that have joined us today to listen in, and to our presenters. Again, thank you, Miguel and Kathy and the team at DWS, for the work that you do to keep us going, and for all of you for being here today and giving us time and navigating a very interesting access point in terms of our talking. So thank you. Motion to adjourn. Thank you, Commissioner Robinson. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.